Higney. He is the Racial Justice Coordinator with the National Council of Churches and is based in New York City. He was here in our area to give a talk last night and will also be giving a talk over the noon hour at Parkland College. So for people here in and around Champaign-Urbana, there is still an opportunity to hear from him if you would like to do that. And, of course, here on this program this morning, you have the opportunity to hear and also to speak with him. Our telephone number here is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us. So around Illinois or over in Indiana or anyplace else, you can call in and use that number. We'll pay for the call. Our telephone, that number is 800-222-9455. So the local number, 333-WILL, and the toll-free number is 800-222-WILL. We'll talk a little bit about the increase in racism in this country, why perhaps that we have seen that, and what we should be doing about it. And again, if you have questions, please do call. Thank you very much for being here.
Glad to be here,
Sheena. This is something that we've talked about with other guests before on the program, and it's something that one really can't ignore. We do seem to have seen a significant increase in racism, in violence perpetrated against people of various ethnic groups, against gays. We've seen an increase in anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic incidents. Let's talk about that. For anybody who might doubt that that is the case, what sort of evidence do we have?
Well, the greatest increase in racially motivated violence in our country is against Asians. The greatest increase, the greatest amount of racially motivated violence is against African Americans, but there's a rapid increase against Asians. There is going on Japanese bashing. I don't think there's any other word for it, and all Asians suffer for that, and it's not fair that Japanese persons are bashed, and it's not fair that all Asians suffer from it. But there's other things going on in the country. A lot of violence against Native Americans, bumper stickers that say spear an Indian, save a walleye, or shoot an Indian, save a deer, as part of the efforts to undercut treaties, legal rights, legal treaties that Indians have, that their nations have, their sovereign nations have with the United States. There is in the country that we know of 18 paramilitary camps training white teenagers for a race war, and they're not all in Idaho. They're throughout the country, and they're Chief of Police in Lamar's, Iowa, has said on television that they use weapons they've gotten from the U.S. Army to train these people for a race war. There's African-American elected officials are being harassed. If you're a black elected official, you're 15 times more likely to be indicted by the Justice Department of the United States than if you're a white elected official. There's a selective prosecution. The infant mortality rate is going up in our country. A child is more likely to live to 1 year of age in Havana, Cuba, than in Washington, D.C. The unemployment rate of African Americans is twice the unemployment rate of European Americans. The median income between African Americans and the differential between African Americans and European Americans is wider now than 10 years ago. There's just all kinds of things going on that are signs of a deep division in our nation. Mm-hmm. And our tendency is to look at the symptoms and try to address that, but we aren't going to address any of these things unless we address the deep division in our nation and in our communities.
Now, I think that when you talk about this, one of the ready conventional explanations for an increase in hate crimes is the economy. And one sees that historical pattern. If you look back, other times when things were very difficult, people feel frustrated, they feel angry, and they look for somebody to blame. I wonder if you think that is in part what is going on, or is that maybe a little too convenient of an explanation?
Well, it's part of the explanation, but there's a lot of scapegoating going on there. There are a lot of There's economic difficulties in our country right now. And people want to know who's responsible. And so you have persons who are willing to scapegoat and say to an unemployed, lower middle class white person, the reason you don't have a job is because of affirmative action. Well, that's absurd. It's not true on a national basis, but that gives a person a way to understand what's happening without having to challenge the whole economic system or to say it's quotas. Well, I mean, the opposition to a civil rights bill to say that people oppose it because it was a quota bill, it wasn't a quota bill. You know, those are code words, affirmative action, quotas. There's other code words out there which signal immediately. It's like a secret language that says more and more to European Americans, to whites, that you are victims in this country. And that's not so. But folks, perception becomes everything. Folks begin to understand that as an explanation for what's happening, and it's not the truth. You know, it's not the truth about what's happening. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think the claim of reverse racism is the most demonic thing going on in our country now, because it isn't true. 10 years ago, African-American men earned $715 for every $1,000 earned by European-American men, 10 years ago. Now, African-American men earn $716 for every $1,000. So there isn't a basis for saying that all these things have served communities of color at the expense of the white community. It's just not so, but people believe it. Mm.
So then I suppose what we have to do is acknowledge the fact that contemporary unease and unrest about where things stand economically and the desire to look for somebody to blame, that gets laid on top of an existing foundation of division along race lines and ethnic and cultural lines we may say, well, this is what's sort of going on now that may be adding to this atmosphere, but that really rests on a kind of a feeling, a division between people that has always been there, has gone back a long time.
But we need to ask, why is that division there? If you look back at when the Constitution was put together, when it was really written to protect the interests of white men who were landowners. It was written for that. And up until that period, this is a way of understanding that I've gotten from the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond in New Orleans, that there's a way in which the people decided, that the people in control at the time, that one of the dangers would be if the freed indentured servants and slaves ever got together, there would be enough power to overthrow, if you will, the government that was in place. At that time, up until that time, people were known really by what country they came from, English or Scottish or whatever. At that point, white was invented. You understand? There wasn't, people weren't called white until then. People invented white at that time in order to develop a majority, if you will. And I think that's important to understand. And then after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, when there was a lot of gains going on, racial gains, those were fought back on two levels. One by the Ku Klux Klan coming in Pulaski, Tennessee, but also that there was an agreement when one of the presidential elections went into the Electoral College. There was an agreement that the Southern members of the Electoral College would vote for one of the candidates if the troops would be pulled out. So when the troops were pulled out, then you have the coming public of the Ku Klux Klan. You're able to push back all those gains. And I would posit, and this is information from the People's Institute, that after the gains of the Civil Rights Movement from, say, 54 to 68 roughly, what we're in now is an effort to push back those gains. So you have a voting rights bill where African Americans can be elected to office, and then you have harassment of African American elected officials. You have Brown versus the Board of Education, and then you have people pushing, you know, wanting to get a voucher system for their kids to go. I think it's ironic that some of the same people who just 10 years ago were against busing because they wanted to keep their kids in neighborhood schools now want a voucher system to get their kids out of neighborhood schools. Now, we have to look at that. And maybe more important, there was an invention successful of something called a Southern strategy, which was code word to – and it wasn't – that didn't have anything to do with the South particularly. It had to do with white men, a way of saying, look, there's something – going on here, where you are the new oppressed persons in our country. There's a silent, the invention of the silent majority, the decimation of the Civil Rights Commission. You know, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission just totally decimated, using quotas as a weapon, vetoing a voting rights bill, claiming reverse discrimination in our schools because they have to be inclusive. We have a tracking system, so white kids can go to a school that, by the figures, is racially inclusive, but still being an all-white classroom, sort of a private school within a public school. All these things are going on, and then to run for political office with Willie Horton as your on your ticket, if you will, then to do all these things, and then feign you're surprised when David Duke comes to your party just doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's there is a whole people out there are trying to blame people of color for what's wrong in this country, and that is unjust.
We have a caller here that I want to get to. I don't want to make them wait too much longer. But maybe just have you continue for a minute or two more, because I imagine some people would hear what you're saying and would say they couldn't dispute the individual facts which you have laid out, but might say that the connection between them is more tenuous. They would hear what you're saying and say, well, it sounds kind of like a conspiracy theory that white people have been involved in working together in this sort of conspiracy, virtually back to the period of the revolution, to keep down non-white people. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that you have to search really hard in history to find people who willingly give up power, and that people do almost anything to keep power, and that one of the things, some of the things in history that we don't learn are some of the ways in which communities of color have always been blamed when there's something wrong in our country. And that's blaming the victims or blaming the people who survive the impact of racism. And that's not a just way of looking at it, and it's not an accurate way. It's just not true. Persons of color don't have the power in our country to cause these difficulties. And I guess I would want to say that the people who control the economic system are the ones who gain from keeping different communities of color pitted against each other, keeping women pitted against people of color, keeping the gay and lesbian bisexual community pitted against communities of color. I mean, if all these communities were to get together, we could have a really exciting democracy in this country. And it seems to me that somebody has something at stake in keeping these groups separated against each other.
Our guest this morning is Joe Agnew. He's the Racial Justice Coordinator with the National Council of Churches, and we're talking about institutional racism. And if you have questions or comments, please do call 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, if we take the position that this is not the kind of society that we want to have, the way as it exists, and we want to change, what should we do? And in particularly, what should white people do?
Well, one of the things that we need to do is own up that racism is a disease, and it's our disease. So, for instance, if I had the power to do it, I would declare that no more white persons could get a PhD for studying the black community. White persons, we need to be studying the white community and discovering why it is that our three-year-olds hate by the time they're 3 years old. What is it that's going on? Why is it that if our children are in a school system and we grow uncomfortable because of the racial mix in that school system, why is it that we move? If we're in a church and we become uncomfortable, that we move? Why is it that we only are willing to be in situations that we think we control? What is there about control that is so important to? Most of the world doesn't live with a sense of control, but that is really important to those of us that are white, that we control every situation that we're in. And I just think that it's we need, those of us who are white, need to look at our own illness. I call this is a cliche a bit, but that I call myself a recovering racist, never a former racist. And I went back to my home community and recently and was on the corner where I used to stand waiting for the bus to go home from high school. Used to be white kids on that corner, the kids of that community. Now there, I went by there recently, and there's African American kids on that corner. And I said to myself, gosh, I didn't know my home community had a gang problem. Now, I have got to ask myself as a white person, why are white kids on a corner white kids on a corner, and black kids on a corner are a gang? I mean, what is there inside my mind that makes that kind of we've got to deal with it, those of us who are white. We also have to learn to believe the experience of people of color. If a person of color says a situation is racist, I think we need to learn to believe that until it's proven otherwise, rather than our usual response is, no, that can't be, that wasn't racism, you got to prove that it was racism. What would it mean for us to assume the experience of persons of color? That's the kind of thing I think we need to be doing as white people.
Well, and we have our first caller here. Let's include them, and certainly want to welcome other people in. If you have comments or questions, we want you to be part of the conversation. 333-WILL or 9455. Toll free, 800-222-WILL. Our first caller here is on line one. Hello.
Oh, good morning, David. I was listening in my car, and I got back, and these are the kind of shows I usually enjoy listening to, but usually don't have much of an opinion on. Conversationally, but your guest said something that really disturbed me, and I want to make sure I got it right because I would challenge it. And it was the last thing he said just before I got in my car, which was about that somehow, I'm paraphrasing, but we are interested in control, but the rest of the world isn't, or something. And I would challenge that. I would say that's a human trait that transcends all cultural and racial boundaries, to at least to a great extent. When I look at China and the former Soviet Union, South America, Indonesia, I don't see that statement's true. Maybe I misunderstood it.
Let's dialogue about that. In your own life, do you experience a need to be in control in the settings that you're in, that you're most comfortable if you are in control of that setting? That you get that your culture decides the norms and the ways, and that you get to decide kind of the rules of that setting? Is that when you're most comfortable?
Well, let me turn it back on you. I certainly enjoy being able to eat. Say I want dinner and I go into a restaurant, I enjoy being able to order what I want and not being told what I have to order. What I'm saying is that I think everyone likes to control some aspect of their life. I don't think it's a unique situation to our culture.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think people do want to have some say, and the problem is that racism or our perspectives, those of us who are white, have been institutionalized so that we have options, we have benefits, we have privileges that communities of color do not have. And what I'm suggesting is we need to enter into the human community in a way where our norms don't decide, that other people get a chance that we live by some other people's norms once in a while.
Right. I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not arguing anything about racism here. It was simply your statement about control, and I just view that as a transcendent human quality, not a quality based on race or culture. And that's the only thing that kind of raised, I guess it kind of flagged a red, it kind of raised a red flag in my mind, because it disturbed me that you saw some intrinsic difference there that I don't see between people.
Well, it's a good conversation, and I'm glad you're raising the question. Maybe another way to come at it would be, I think all human beings want to have some control over their own lives, But maybe where racism comes in is the need that those of us who are white have to control other people's lives. And maybe that might be something that we want to look at, why it is if we're not controlling the institutions and other people who are about us that we withdraw and pull out. Maybe that's the distinction that would help in our conversation.
Well, David, I tell you, I was just grateful to be able to raise this point, because when I heard it, I just felt that it wasn't true, but I do see the point that your guest is trying to make. So
okay.
I'll sign off and listen.
Well, thanks for the call. And, you know, I'm glad that the caller raised it, because I thought about it as well, and thinking that it, you know, there must be black people who are racist and Asian people who are racist and Hispanic people who are racist, and we can't we can't say that white people have a corner on them. The racism market.
Well, let's talk about that, because, and maybe it's how you define the term. I would say all human beings are prejudiced. It's not possible to be a human being without being prejudiced, that we have assumptions based on incomplete information. All human beings are prejudiced. But those of us who are white, at least in this society, have the institutional power that gets behind our prejudices. And so that, my understanding of my definition of racism would be prejudice plus the power to racial prejudice plus the power to enforce those prejudices on other people. African Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Hispanic Americans, Latinos, do not have significant enough power in any institution in our country that they determine things for me. Now, that's what I mean by racism. Now, an individual may be in an institution, but if that person quote unquote misbehaves in an institution, that person of color, they're gone. They're out of the white norms predominate in the institutions, and I just think that's a reality, and that is racism. Now, I wouldn't argue with you that white persons have a corner on being prejudiced. Being prejudiced is part of the human condition, but racism is an institutional issue. It's the institutionalization of white prejudices.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk with somebody else. Line two next.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether I understood right. I was just half listening as I was working here. But you were questioning why people move away. And I wanted to give a personal angle on that. I have a child who's 9 years old here in a school. We're Jews. And he's been suffering time after time after time from little racial incidents, be it from teachers refusing to let him cover his head, as is our custom, at school, to friends saying racist things to him, to the playground and lunchroom supervisor who has challenged his prayers after the meal, which he does in private, and has consistently ruled against him in the playground to the point that he never seeks help anymore. And there was a time just a couple of months ago he came home and he seemed a little bit down, and I asked him how was school. He said it was okay, and then we talked a little bit about other things, and then I asked him again, was everything okay at school? And he told me how he was excluded from a game in the playground, and with a Jewish comment, you can be the Jew-juicer, which he didn't understand, nor do I, but it certainly hurt him very much. And I asked him, why didn't you go to somebody? Why didn't you tell your teacher? And he looked at me with terribly sad eyes, and he said, I was just tired. I just wasn't up to this, he said. I just didn't feel like going again to the principal or to whoever it is, and he will deny it, and I'll say, yes, you said it, and nothing will happen anyway. And here is a good example why people would want to move.
I understand
adults
that.
Adults may feel strong enough for battle for so long, but no adult feels strong enough for battle when their children are the ones who are doing it. And it puts me on the verge of tears to even talk about this. And here you have, you're speaking to a man, the host of this show, who just a few weeks ago said that as a Gentile, he doesn't see the Holocaust as something that should interest him personally. He can correct my language, but he certainly said that in such a way that many people felt very, very bad, and some called in immediately Jews and Gentiles. We live in a society where we're terribly isolated. You didn't bring much of the Jewish angle up. This is how we live. And we have had people yell at us as we walk on the streets. We've had anti-Semitic calls. And I am trying to get away. Of course, it's only going to be a sabbatical, but to simply protect my child from constantly being a victim or a potential victim. And here you have a sensitive child who is deeply upset when he sees discrimination against girls in the playground, against black children, and he is constantly on the receiving end of racism. And I'd like you to understand that when people move away because they are in the minority, they are weak, they are tired, and they want to go on with their life without constantly being victims. Half of my son's great-grandfather's family, half of my husband's family, more than a half was annihilated in the Holocaust. And we don't want to be victims all the time. And that's why people move away. I just wanted to make that comment. Perhaps you have something to say.
I understand that, and I understand that in some ways to be supporting what I was trying to say, and I don't know whether we had a misunderstanding or not. The experience that you describe is the experience that parents of black children have all the time in predominantly white schools also, and Latino children have all the time. And I think that there are some things going on in our society that try to pit people who are oppressed against each other, and we've got to work to make sure that doesn't happen, because we've got power and strength if we work together against that which oppresses persons who are not in the majority. But we lose our strength. So we need to not have a struggle over our hierarchy of suffering, who has suffered the most, but to move through our own suffering to understand others who suffer. So what I was talking about wasn't the situation you were describing in your family, which you describe with deep feeling, and which I understand and which moves me. I'm talking about white people who leave a community because there's too many Jewish persons Gentiles who leave because there's too many Jewish persons in a community, or white persons who leave because there's too many people of color. I'm trying to understand what is there about those of us who are white of European background who we leave when we feel like we're not in control. I want to understand that, and I think it's really important. If we're going to solve the racial separation problems in our country, we've got to understand that. We've got to figure out what that's about.
We are a little bit past the halfway point here, and I appreciate what the caller had to say. We do have some other people I want to include as well. So let me just take a moment to reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Joe Agnew. He's the Racial Justice Coordinator with the National Council of Churches. Again, if you'd like to call in, our lines now are full, so you might have to wait, but we'll try and accommodate as many people as we can. We'll just have to ask folks to try and be brief and to the point, and that way we'll accommodate more callers. Well, let's go on. Let's go to line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I wanted to comment on the first two callers. The first man was questioning the whole idea of white people wanting to control things. And the second caller's very moving story, I think, connects with the first and what I'd like to suggest. And that is that black Americans, and I am a black American or Asian American or Hispanic American, are really pressured to assimilate into the white middle class model. That means dropping any kind of a language that you may have, or speak standard English, read, you know, the material that pushes the Eurocentric, you know, view of the world. And if you don't assimilate, and if you want to hang on to some kind of ethnic difference, you really are made to feel totally marginalized. And I think the second caller's story was straight to that point. But I think this push to make minorities assimilate is another example of whites wanting to control the definition of what it means to be an American. I'd like you to comment on that.
Yeah, I agree with that. That the norms of all of society are to be there's enormous pressure on children of color to act like the white community thinks children ought to act in schools, and the high number of children of color who are put into special classes and who end up in difficulty in a school system that isn't geared up to deal with children who come out of the African American community or other communities, that's very painful, and that's a form of institutional racism, and we need to figure out a way how to address that. I think that's very important.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go on. Toll free line next. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I heard part of what the previous caller, this second caller, had to say about the host making some comment about Jews regarding Jews. I feel the same way. I heard the host say something about conspiracy. It seems that if you want to, now I'm not accusing him of that, but if you want to make an argument, all you have to say, or knock down someone else's argument, is all you have to say is that, well, that's a conspiracy theory, and so obviously you're flaky. Well, however, it's not a conspiracy. It doesn't have to be a conspiracy. The if you look at the many blacks who've been lynched in this country, the horrible lynchings have taken place throughout history and can still continue. You find that who perpetrates most of those? It's the poor whites, and particularly in the South. When there's a convergence of interest between the poor whites and the blacks, who are poor, who are poor, period, in this country because of their isolation and discrimination, the power structure divides and tends to manipulate the feelings and to achieve their ends, just as Hitler did. And I would say that it doesn't have to be a conspiracy. All of the injustice that goes on in this country is the result of manipulation and a form of conspiracy. Now, but just to call a theory a conspiracy theory, and then it's like an ad hominem argument almost. However, I would like to ask you, sir, isn't it a question of our emperor has no clothes? It starts in the White House, and with Willie Horton, he attempts to manipulate the feelings toward the Jewish vote. I mean, the Jewish people, with his attitudes toward Israel and the. After all, we promoted the movement of Soviet Jews to Israel very strongly throughout the Cold War, and that was one of the aims. And then now that it's happening, thank God that people are able to move freely like that. Our emperor with no clothes puts up all of these manipulative things that appear, and I think they're more than appearance. Actually, he is attempting to divide us along Gentile Jewish lines and so on and so forth. Can't we get some leadership from? Isn't a president supposed to be a moral leader rather than an amoral or immoral leader? Is what we have. So I appreciate your comments.
Let me comment on something you said particularly. I would like to see some academics, if they would, do some studies comparing the 20s and 30s in Germany to the 80s and 90s in the United States. There are many comparisons, I think, that would be fruitful to look at. Harassment of a harassment and developing of legal legislation against a racial group, harassment of gay and lesbian and bisexual people, attacks on the academic world, this whole politically correct attacks on the campus. Some people think that happens spontaneously. I think that is part of the attack on the intellectual community in this country. And the effort is to keep the intellectual community, to keep white persons who are against racism, to keep people of color, to keep gay, lesbian, bisexual people all separated from each other, because together we could have a real coalition that would bring, that would make this the most could make this the most exciting country in the world. The year 2000 is going to be important. At the end of each century is always conservative, always conservative. But in the midst of that conservatism, there are the seeds planted for the new possibilities of community and life in the next century. We're at the end of a millennium. So I think what's happening is this real conservative movement and a very racist movement, but there are people within who are saying we don't want racism in this country, and we've got to figure out ways to support those people because they feel marginalized and isolated. They're in every community in our country. We've got to find ways to support them. The year 2000 will show either that we've made some headway on that, or I'm afraid it will show a return to a kind of strong control that is nothing less than very similar to what was happening in Germany.
We just have about 10 minutes left. We have several callers here. I want, though, if they will indulge me, to take a minute to respond now, as two callers have called in and made reference to comments that I made on a previous program. I feel like I really need to take a moment to try to make clear what it was I was trying to say. And I'm interested in what you would have to say about it, too. This was an interview I did some weeks back with an Israeli author, and the Holocaust figures prominently in his writing. So we were sitting here, he was sitting here, and we were talking. And here's the point that I was trying to make. Although it may be that I chose my words badly. I don't have my questions written out in front of me to read. And I say this at the risk of getting myself in trouble again, because it made some people angry. The point that I was trying to make was this. I said to him, I thought that for a lot of people, I might have even said most people, who weren't Jewish, that the Holocaust had little or no significance. And then I went on to, and my purpose in saying the statement that way was to get him to say what he thought the Holocaust should be to anyone. And a couple of people got angry about that. And in fact, I heard later that someone had made the comment to one of our station managers who had heard it, who also was unhappy about the comment, that it was as if I had said, you have to be black to understand slavery. And I guess my response would be that wasn't what I meant at all. What I would say would be, it would certainly be possible for white people to understand slavery. What I would say is that I think white people just don't think anything about it. It doesn't have much significance for them. And again, as I would say, I'm probably getting myself in trouble again, I think that for a lot of people who are not Jewish, I'm not saying the Holocaust can't have significance or that they can't understand it. What I would say is that they just don't think anything about it. It has no meaning for them.
Well, but we better think about it.
Well, I would agree with you completely.
I think that we need to be clear that the Holocaust that generated out of Germany and was supported by people in our own country, we need to understand that was horrible. The Holocaust that Native Americans experienced in this country was horrible. The Holocaust that African Americans experienced in the whole centuries of slavery and continued oppression is horrible. We need to not get into a battle over a hierarchy of Holocausts. Whose was the worst? Those people who oppress sit back and enjoy it. If we can pit the Jewish community and the African-American community and the Native communities against each other, if these communities could somehow join in struggle against that which oppresses people of color and oppresses persons in this country, there could be a strong movement for justice. And so I just think that you and I are white. We have a responsibility to say to everybody who is white and everybody who is a Gentile, the Holocausts are something that ought to be central to our thinking. One of the quote unquote privileges of being white in this country is that we don't have to reflect, because the systems serve us. We don't have to reflect on the benefits and the privileges, and especially those of us who have access for 2 hours a day to the public through the media. We need to make sure that people are understanding, because I think we're moving toward a Holocaust again. I think there is genocide in our country. I think on the Sea Islands off the Carolinas, when resorts build resorts so people can play golf on African-American cemeteries, that is genocide. The destruction of the Gullah culture, that is genocide. The decimation of black men in this country, that is genocide. And I think we need to not be afraid to name that we're in the midst of ongoing Holocaust, and we dare not step back and argue about whose oppression is the worst. We need to stop the oppressing.
Well, I apologize, because there'll be some people here we can't get on, but I want to make sure that people who are listening understand personally how I feel about this, and that if I didn't think the issues we were talking about here on this program were extremely important, we wouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
And we would not have the record of doing programs raising these issues that we have now for about 11 years.
Right.
So I want to make sure people know where I sit on this.
Yeah.
Having said that, let's go on and talk with some other folks. We'll go to line number three next.
Hi. I have so much to say. I know you only have a limited time. I'm going to restrain myself. I want to take a linguistic issue with your speaker on several matters. First of all, number one, the use of the word racism. Now, your speaker is a proponent of a new concept in this discussion, which essentially says that racism is a word which describes a prejudicial feeling together with the power to put that prejudicial feeling into effect. Now, I think that's a pernicious way of looking at things for two important reasons. Number one, that gives an absolution for racism for people of color. It means that if a person of color expresses prejudice, well, that's prejudice, but it's not racism. But people, in using those terms, don't make those distinctions very carefully. And prejudice and racism are used almost as interchangeable. And so I think it does not contribute to the solution to all of these problems to essentially make that little twist, that linguistic twist, which puts people of color in one category and whites in a different category. The other reason that I think that's a very pernicious way of using the term is the fact that that power is not uniformly placed in one group or another. There are many local situations, for example, in which people of color have distinct power. And the misuse of that power on prejudicial grounds ought not to be absolved of the term racism, because it is racism. The second point I want to make is that in the last comment that your speaker made in regard, for example, to the Holocaust and genocide, his use of the word genocide is another good example of the very loose and, I think, terribly destructive way in which terms are degraded. It is not the same thing to say that building a golf course on a cemetery, pernicious as that is exactly the same thing and should be called the same thing as systematically destroying a people, as the Belgians, for example, did in what was then called the Belgian Congo. Those are different acts, and to simply put them under the same category is a disservice to every person of goodwill who wants to do something decent in this world. Thanks.
Go ahead. That's important, what you're saying, and I think part of what needs to happen, we need to acknowledge that for those of us who are white, the word racism is loaded, and so we want to get into discussions about what does it really mean and make sure we have the accurate definition, and we could spend hours, if not years, working on definitions. Even more loaded is the word genocide. I understand that, but there are communities of color, people in communities of color who feel that there is genocide going on in our country. And what I'm saying is, could we not bring down our denial, bring down our defensiveness, and try to listen to that experience and understand what is being said? And see, the destruction of a culture that's going on in the Sea Islands is a form of genocide. It's a destruction of people. The fact that African-Americans own less land in this country than they did 10 years ago, that's a form of genocide. Land has everything to do with survival, and the loss of land by Indians, that's a form of genocide. So I want to stand by my use of those words, and I do think the most important thing to discuss is power. a lot of us who are white would like to talk about prejudice because we don't want to talk about power. Power resides with white people in our country, in all institutions. Tell me one institution which is controlled by people of color, which determines my life as a white person. I can't think of one, and I'd love to have a conversation with you about it.
Sure, I can tell you one. I could tell you, for example, that in certain areas of the black press, that the black journalists who are in control of that black press, I certainly don't suggest that that's an improper control, they have the ability to influence people in a way which is often terribly prejudicial to other people.
I agree.
It is done on the basis of prejudiced or racist attitudes.
They don't determine my life.
Well, of course, nor would
because
nor
the black press doesn't have the power to do that.
But nor do I have the power. The sort of things that I do in my daily life does not control the lives of the vast majority of African Americans in this community.
I understand what you're saying. I understand. The issue might be to look at the way that you benefit from the way power is configured and the way you have privilege from the way power is configured.
Of course, and there are certain ways in which, given modern applications of affirmative actions, that many African Americans benefit from the way power is distributed, and rightly so. The point is this, you see, I think you've got to make a distinction between, on the one hand, being sensitive to the way in which other people are treated, and on the other hand, to simply say that a person of color is not capable of expressing racism.
That
rubs me the wrong way, and I find it will not contribute to the cause that, as I say, all people of goodwill are behind.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Are you a person? Are you committed to work against white racism?
I am not only committed, I have done so all of my life, and I'll give you, if you want a list of particulars, we can meet some other time, I'd be happy to give you that.
Okay, well,
I've stood on picket lines on behalf of open occupancy and have had people ride by me and throw eggs at my face, and I've done that all of my life, and I continue to do that.
You know, I want to say something. I think it's really important, and it's not so much a conversation with you, as a lot of people who were involved in the struggles with Dr. King in the 60s now are positioned in positions of power and sort of have forgotten the vision that we shared then. And I'm real concerned about that we recover that vision, that sense of possibility, that sense of who we could be as a nation. I consider myself a liberal person, and I think we need to look at liberal racism. I think one of the things those of us who are liberal like is colorful institutions, as long as white people maintain control. And if we lose control of those institutions, then we step out and go on to other institutions. And I just think that's something we need to look at as people in this country.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of our time. And my apologies, we have several people we can't take. I'm sure we could profitably continue to the next hour if we had that option, but we don't. Our guest this morning, Joe Agnew, Racial Justice Coordinator for the National Council of Churches. Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.